Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager. My first guest tonight is a rising star in the alternative media, the host of a popular daily radio program on Republic Broadcasting Network, and the author of a book that has just been published titled The Ruling Elite, A Study in Imperialism, Genocide, and Emancipation. My guest is Deanna Spingola, and her two-hour daily radio program on RBN is Spingola Speaks. Welcome to the Heretics Hour, Deanna.
Well, thank you very much for having me on, Carolyn.
Well, it's a great pleasure. You know, I've been wanting to have you on for a while. We wanted to wait until your book came out. Now it's out, and that must be a very exciting event for you.
It is. It is. It's very nice. It was a long time coming. So it finally was in paper, and I'm really happy about that.
Okay, well, we'll talk about that more in a minute, but, you know, this is not your first book. I want you to tell us about your previous books, but, you know, I want to say that you're a very impressive woman to me, and you are the opposite of what the Germans used to call a shirker. You have many accomplishments, and I want you to tell our listeners first about what you've done in your earlier life before this phase of your life, and again, these previous books.
All righty. Back in the mid-90s, I was a sales rep. I was repping several different textile companies, and I got involved in quilting, and usually when I get involved in something, I really go all out and learn as much about it as I can. And I discovered a different method of doing something that was then very, very popular called watercolor quilting. And what they used to do is cut out a bunch of 2-inch squares and then get a palette and just start putting these squares up to make kind of a watercolor style painting. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, a palette of some sort. And I thought, I did a couple of those, and I thought, this 2-inch square business is just too much work. So I figured out how to do it with strip piece quilting, which is if you get a bunch of strips, and you sew those together, and then you cut them, and then put together a quilt. And it was much faster, much easier, just really, really expedited the whole process. And so, well, first I approached the publishing company that had published the first book on this 2-inch square business, and I said, you know, there's got to be an easier way, and I've discovered it, and would you be interested in publishing my book? And they were very excited about it. It, you know, took me about a year to do it because there were 30 patterns that I created, and I had to create a quilt for each of those patterns. And I got a couple of other people to help me, and they made some quilts from the book, and it came out, and it was so popular that within 9 days, they had to republish it because it sold out so quickly. And then I wrote another book with some more intricate patterns using the same method, and it was really fun. And I traveled all over the country and taught my method and had classes and put on presentations. It was quite a lot of fun. And I gave up my representing all these textile companies, and it was very enjoyable. And
How long were you doing that? It sounds like if you started in the 90s, it wasn't all that many years, and yet look at all you did.
Well, I did that for about 7 years, and then I got really tired of traveling, and I was on the road all the time. It was very nice. I enjoyed meeting people, I enjoyed teaching classes, but I didn't enjoy being away from home. Because I had been away from home for a good deal of the time before that, for the previous, about 1988, when I became a sales rep. And I was on the road all the time because I traveled in five different states here in the Midwest. So I was really getting really tired of traveling.
Well, now, all this information and about your books and your quilting and examples of your amazing quilts are on your website, which is spingola.com, right?
Right.
I forgot to mention that in the beginning. You know, you've done so much. Okay, so then how, from there, did you get interested in what you're doing now with basically researching history?
Well, during the time that I was a sales rep, and up until April of last year, I was the director of the local Family History Center. And I had been doing research, family history research, for a long time, a very long time. And so I learned how to look at records, to investigate different, you know, titles and property searches and that kind of thing. And I knew how to do research. And back in the early 80s, I was also very interested in what was going on in the government. And I read None Dare Call It Conspiracy by Gary Allen and got involved in politics. But I had young children, and it was very difficult to do all of these things.
Yeah.
And so also I discovered that when you start talking about things that other people really weren't interested in, that they kind of turned you off. And in fact, I even joined the John Birch Society at one point in time until I, years later, discovered who financed them. But, you know, I got involved in looking into these things quite a long time ago. And I've always been a really big book collector. So I just combined those kinds of things that the research and
well, all along you were reading these books. Were you buying and reading books along these lines besides the Gary Allen book that you mentioned all these years?
Not necessarily. During my quilting stage, which actually came after my doll making stage, which is another altogether different kind of thing.
Okay.
But my quilting stage, I was buying a lot of quilt books and studying color and how to put color together and shades and, you know, more the right-brained activities. And then I burned out on the right-brained activities, and I thought, well, I better develop the left-brained activities. So I went back to political investigation, and that's what I've been doing. I started writing articles in about 2005, because now I was home. I didn't have to, you know, get ready to go on another trip to teach another class. And so I had more time at home where I could actually get into some of the things that I had an interest in earlier, the political things. I remember working for Ross Perot. In fact, I still have a Ross Perot button. And I was definitely interested in those political things when I was on the road as a textile rep. But I just couldn't get really into it because when you're working as many hours as I was working and still had a child at home and whatnot, it was, you know, I had a lot of things that I had to get done, take care of, have responsibility for. And I was divorced at that time, so it was just a difficult thing that I couldn't, you know, I couldn't investigate everything that I wanted to do. But,
you amaze me. Because I want to, I'll just interject here real quickly that I want the listeners to know that I heard you say on one of your programs recently that you get up at 5 a.m. And I was sure you were an early riser, but 5 a.m. is really early. But you explained to me that was, you really would prefer to sleep later, but you just wake up then.
Right? Well, it started when I had friends that I used to go to the gym with, and most of these people worked, and so actually I was getting up at 4:30.
You were going to the gym too. We need everybody to know that all
right.
The time.
So I was going to the gym, which I did for at least 6 years straight until I had this I had an accident. But I would get up at 4:30 because we would meet at the gym out in the little foyer that they had and be there at 25 after 5 so that we could all rush in and at 5:30 when they opened and get the machines all in a row that we wanted. There was four of us. And we wanted to get the machines that we wanted all in a row and, you know. So, anyway, that's... But I do like to get up early. In fact, I got up early before that, and when we all decided that we would start working out, I said, well, we have to do it early in the morning. Let's get this thing over with so that we can go on with the rest of the day. But I've always been an early riser. Even as a child, I was up early. That's who
well,
I am.
That's good for you. I do think that there are people who naturally are late risers and like to stay up late at night. I found that out. But I used to think that the best for everybody is to get up earlier. Of course, you're supposed to get up with the sun.
Sure.
But anyway, I interrupted you kind of, but we're still talking about how you got started in researching and writing about history.
Right. So after I quit traveling with my quilting and whatnot, then I just started to investigate history and politics and all of this corruption and started writing articles for News with Views. And then I several other sites picked me up, and I also was on a few radio programs.
Mm-hmm. Well, I first heard you on the Mike Piper show.
Oh,
and
yes.
I think he mentioned you called in a couple of times, or one time, and your website was mentioned, and I went and looked at it. And I thought, well, look at all the writing she's done. So anyway, that was a few years back now. And now here we are. We both have radio shows. And how did you get on the RBN network?
Well, I had been a guest on Rick Adams and a few other programs, R.J. Hender, and I thought I was done with my book. And let me just talk about my book just a little bit. Back in 2008, in December 2008, two publishers approached me and said, would you please write a book for our company? And two of them approached me within 2 days, and I went with the first company. And we decided that I would write a book about 400 to 500 pages long. And so I just kept writing it, because with articles, you're really restricted to about 2,000 words. And so I thought, well, I can just write everything that I want to write. And before I knew it, I had a book that was over 1,200 pages long.
Oh.
And so...
You're amazing. All right.
So we decided that we would split it up into three separate books. And so I finished what I thought was the first book and got it sent into the publisher. And I thought, well, gosh, what am I going to do now? So I called John Stattmiller at RBN, and I said, you are not well represented as far as having female hosts. You really need to have some more female hosts on your network. And I said, I would like to do a program. I'd never been a host on a radio program ever. And so he said, okay, how about Saturday from 9 to 11? Which I thought, okay, whatever, I can do that. It was the hardest thing I've ever had to do because I only did it for 3 weeks. But I forced myself to lay down to try and take a nap, because by 9 o'clock, I don't want to talk to anyone. I can't talk to anyone. I'm not.
Oh, this was 9 o'clock in the evening.
Yeah. Yes, it was terrible. It was torture. Because my brain shuts
off
about
8. Did you have guests then, or were you just talking for 2 hours?
The first one I just talked for 2 hours, because it was really very sudden. I really didn't have time to get guests, I had to feel my way into this.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so the next two Saturday nights I did have guests, and then I believe it was November 8th, he gave me an opportunity to have a Monday through Friday program from 1 to 2 in the afternoon. And that started November the 8th, I believe. And then I guess people said, why don't you give her 2 hours? And I was also saying, you know, I don't have enough time to really do anything in a 1 hour period of time. So I believe it was the 13th of December, I went to 2 hours.
Yes, and you know, with the because RBN has those commercial breaks, it really isn't as much time. It's not; it's far from an hour. So you really
sure
need 2 hours.
Sure,
if you want to develop something. So, and then you have been put on. I understand you're opposite Alex Jones for a reason, and you also have 1 hour on shortwave.
Right? They stopped the shortwave. Maybe a month ago.
Oh, okay.
And okay. So that's how I got into radio.
Well, and you've become in a short period of time, you have popular, and I know that, and so it's just great. Let's go back to your book.
All right.
Now I learned in your book. I've gone all through it, but I haven't actually read it. But I've read some parts of it, and I've kind of looked through the whole thing. And one thing that stands out, I want to tell the readers that it's 684 pages, and it can be bought now at Amazon, and also at your publisher, www.trafford.com. And you know, I saw that at Amazon you can buy the paperback for $17.86, and at Trafford you have to pay $31.45 for it.
Exactly. So buy it at Amazon.
Yeah. Well, anybody would, wouldn't they? So
sure.
So the publishers don't give any kind of discounts or whatever, do they?
No, they just set a price, and I mean, I kind of had to agree with it. And I was hoping that Amazon, see, the reason that Amazon can do it for such a price is because they buy in huge quantities.
Yes. And that's good. And now $17.86 is a very, very reasonable and good price. I don't want to say cheap, but, you know, very low price for a 684 book of the quality of your book. Now, your book has listeners, there are almost 2,000 footnotes in this book, 1,998 to be exact. And you can easily, as you get up into those 1,900 numbers, start confusing it with the year, thinking that the footnote refers to that year, but don't do that. Anyway, and your footnotes are at the bottom of each page, which is the way they should be, in my opinion, for ease of seeing exactly what each footnote is, you know, where it comes from.
Sure.
And so everything about your book, is, and you have a nice index, which I used to look up the Brown Brothers and the Browns, which I'll talk about in a minute. So everything, and also the other thing I want to say is that it's in a very easy reading style. This is a lot of in-depth history, and yet it's not arcane. It's not hard to read. It's easy to read and follow, it seemed to me. So that those are all very good things, and so that you've done there, and I recommend this book. Now, you also told me that this is book one. Oh, you already mentioned that, yeah, of the trilogy.
Right.
Yeah. So
and book
really
one, amazing. You know, when you figure I got up to 1,200 pages, and then we divided it into three, so 684 pages, I wrote a little bit more than the 400 that, you know, originally should have been.
Yes, obviously.
But that's the way it is. I just had a lot of things to say, I guess.
Well, there is so much, you know. I mean, so people need to know that if they want to learn about these periods of time, they're going to find it in your book, I think. You know, it looks to me like they will. And it won't be that hard for them to read it and understand it and find it. So this is really a great book that you've written. Now, I was struck when I went through your whole book and read parts of it just the other day, that I was struck by this very profound idea, which isn't really profound. I mean, it's profound, but it isn't really unusual. It's not like nobody's ever had it or I haven't, but it really hit me from your book that money is really at the root or the heart of so much of the evil in the world, if not all of it, because it's really the great attraction of wealth that causes people who are so good at attracting wealth or good at want wealth so much to pass laws, create conditions, and make decisions that are not in the best interest of the people in the long run, but are in the interest of their accumulating wealth. And your book is full of examples of that. What would
exactly.
you say to that?
Yes. Well, I begin with the banking and industrial elite. That's the first section in my book, and then I talk about the Rothschilds, I talk about their gold operations, I talk about the foundation of greed, globalization, and banking. I talk about the Bank of the United States, New York City, the center of mercantilism, and I basically set the foundation for Lincoln's War when I discussed the South as a profitable colony, because that's how the North treated the South, as a colony that had two cash crops, tobacco and cotton. And it was the North and the Northern industrialists and the bankers who made most of the profit off of those cash crops, just as they use the cash crops out of Afghanistan to make money.
Mm-hmm. It's all about making money.
All of it.
I mean,
yeah.
I mean, people say that, but I don't know if you know, when things are said often, it becomes kind of a cliche, and you don't hear it anymore. And but the idea that that money rules in this way is really what causes everything to go astray, because
sure.
the interests of the general community is not taken into account at all. In fact, it's sacrificed to this desire for money.
Sure.
It really, and you know, it recalls that the biblical scripture, and I'm not particularly biblical, but I did used to read the Bible a lot, and I think it was Jesus who is attributed to saying the love of money is the root of all evil.
Sure.
Does that come from?
It comes from the Bible.
Jesus. Yeah, it comes from the Bible.
And of course, he was totally against usury, and that was one of the few times that he actually expressed anger, is over the money changers in the temple courtyard who were exchanging money and charging interest for it. Because, you know, it was an international, Jerusalem was an international city, and the people would come to the temple courtyard, to the temple, and bring foreign coins, and the money changers would be there to exchange money for local currency, and they charged usury. And this is one thing that made him very angry.
Yes, so we know who are the major
money changers
and users of usury.
Sure.
Is the Jews throughout history. And I think that this influence of the Jews in so many societies has caused the people there to get caught up, because money is like an addiction. It becomes an attraction to come to believe that, well, they want this money too, and the Jews help them to get it. And that's how the Jews have managed to get so powerful. But look
sure.
at the cost here. I want to point out something that I read in your book, which is not an unknown fact. But again, it's something that I think doesn't really hit home to people as much as it should, which it had never to me. And that's that during the Civil War, Lincoln's War, you call it, 622,000 Americans died in that war. And that is more than... World War One and Two, the Korean War, and the Vietnam War combined. Now, that's shocking.
Mm-hmm.
That's a shocking number. You know, maybe I would read 622,000, I wouldn't think much about it, and then I would read the Vietnam War, and I might forget that that's not even as much, half as much as the Civil War. And, you know, these kind of things, they can't be brought home to us often enough, because, you know, to understand the terrible evil that the Civil War was.
It was a terrible evil. Additionally, if you really read the background of it and understand who was fighting on the North and understand who Lincoln was, and that he was basically had some very socialistic ideas, and it was that war, Lincoln's War, that set the stage for the corporations to come in and for everything that followed after that, including the imposition of the Federal Reserve.
Well, that's interesting to link the Federal Reserve with the Civil War.
But that's...
And do you actually make that connection in this book?
I do.
Okay.
I
well,
do.
Good. That's
and,
good.
And of course, you have to wait until the second book comes out to get all the details of the Federal Reserve, because the book can only be so long.
Yes, well, I was reading about the Brown family, and it turns out there's two Brown families. One of them is the one that was the Brown Brothers that joined with Harriman. Turned Brown Brothers Harriman. And I learned a few things there, and I did a little more research, and I have some new information now from that. So I appreciate that. Well, Deanna, this short little time we had is already come to an end. I want to thank you so much for being on. Your website is Spingola.com, real easy to remember. Your program, Spingola Speaks, is at 12 noon until 2 p.m. Central Time, Monday through Friday on Republic Broadcasting Network. And I do recommend people to go to Amazon and look for your book titled The Ruling Elite, A Study in Imperialism, Genocide, and Emancipation. Diana, you are a very special person, I will say. So
well,
thanks
thank you.
Again.
Thank you very much for having me on.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Listeners, we will be right back after this break with Eric Hunt. So stay with us.
We'll be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Well, breaking news this hour, the U.S. President Barack Obama has confirmed that Osama bin Laden has been killed in a special operation in Pakistan. The news flashed around the world with the U.S. claiming it's now in possession of his body. RT's Lucy Kafanov has the latest from Washington, D.C.
U.S. President Barack Obama addressed the nation to announce, in fact, that the United States can finally confirm that Osama bin Laden has been killed by U.S. Special Forces. We're hearing that it was not a drone attack. This was actually a firefight on the ground by U.S. Special Forces right outside of Islamabad. There was a firefight that was exchanged. Osama bin Laden had reportedly been shot and killed in the head, and his body is apparently now in U.S. custody. The president addressed the nation right now just earlier ago to announce this major development. And also, we are just blocks away from the White House right now, where there have been hundreds of people who have gathered right outside of the White House in celebration of the developments that bin Laden has been confirmed killed by U.S. President Barack Obama. In fact, even as I was making my way to the studio, we've seen cars driving by honking, American flags waving, and people continue to make their way down towards the White House to celebrate this news that, in fact, the United States has been pursuing for the past decade since the 9/11 attacks. It's been 10 years in Afghanistan nearly since 10 years since the 9/11 attacks, which really, really started the active hot conflict on the ground in Afghanistan. But we cannot forget that the roots of conflict so often go back to foreign policy decisions made years and years ago. And, while the president did say in his speech tonight that the American people did not choose this fight. This fight came to the United States in U.S. soil, referencing, of course, the 9/11 attacks. We have to remember that the United States policy of covertly arming the Mujahideen in Afghanistan back in the 80s had, of course, contributed so much to the current situation that we have on the ground today. And it's one of those things that, unfortunately, in Washington sort of gets really lost in the mix. We don't really see the consequences of certain foreign policy actions as they relate to the present news developments on the ground.
Well, for more on the international anti-terror fight, I spoke to RT's correspondents Marina Kochaneva in Russia's North Caucasus and Anissa Narway in Moscow.
The U.S. is reveling in celebrations of what they're calling a victory and justice being served. Thousands of people gathered outside the White House chanting USA, USA. But in all these celebrations, what I think is being lost is the question of what now? What does that mean for global terrorism? I mean, when was the last time we heard Osama bin Laden take credit for a major terror attack? It's been years, and that's been...
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and with me is Eric Hunt, the producer of the film Last Days of the Big Lie. This film can be viewed on YouTube and also at www.holocaustdenier.com and at www.revisionistworkshop.com. Eric is here to tell us about his latest activities and upcoming plans. So, hello, Eric.
Hi. First of all, I'd like to say congratulations on your work exposing Dennis Avey. What a great job you've done for the past year exposing that liar. And your recent articles are just really, really great to read. The best work out there on the subject.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I wanted to let my listeners know that they should be reading that, and they can go to Inconvenient History revisionistblog.com to find them, and that is, or they can even go to my website and to find them and be directed there, or even to your Revisionist Workshop website. So thank you. I think that's an important story, and that's a part of what we're going to maybe have a chance to talk about later, about how we need to be approaching this revisionist work. So tell us first about the Revisionist Workshop website. That's brand new.
Okay. Well, Friedrich Paul Berg and I have been talking about how there was a need to have some sort of real-world organization to collect the, you know, revisionists around the country and around the world and sort of organize us, network us, get us moving in one direction. I think deliberately we've been made to sort of live in fear and, you know, do our work anonymously as individuals, when in reality that's not going to get the job done, really. So we're trying to network talented graphic artists, video makers, researchers, just all the talent we have in the revisionist community in one place, hopefully to work towards the goal of exposing the truth about what happened in the camps during World War II.
Well, the website is very handsome looking. I will say that. I hope it stays that way because it's so clean. Sometimes as things get more things get added and more people involved, you know, there's so much going on that then it's not quite as clean. But you're good at designing all these things. But now, how do you envision that all the revisionists can work together via a kind of a internet workshop?
Yeah. Well, right now it's hard. It's hard just getting the thing off the ground. But, you know, the power of videos is something that's sort of gone untapped in our movement, you could say. Mm-hmm. It's only really recently that some videos have started to emulate the sort of, you could say, Michael Moore style documentary. One Third of the Holocaust is an example of that. And now on YouTube, there's a lot of talented video makers with really slick graphics and editing. So right now, one of the best things we're doing is getting talented video makers in contact with some of the older revisionists and helping them make videos out of their points and their works. Fritz Berg has had people helping him make videos. And, you know, it's some of us are computer savvy and some of us are more adept at explaining the intricacies of the phony gas chamber story. So we're just trying to gather our people with our different strengths and trying to work together. It's hard to say, you know, in America we haven't had a really good revisionist organization in a long time.
Yeah, that's a very good idea, because a lot of people who are very much interested in this and into it, and yet, and they're good video makers, they're not that deeply knowledgeable in the facts, and they can make videos that are not quite right, you know.
Yeah.
So to get them together with these serious revisionists who are really into all the detail but don't have the foggiest idea how to make a video or anything like that, that's an excellent idea. I mean, I don't think you can come up with anything better than that.
Absolutely.
And unfortunately, the videos are, you know, I would like it if people wanted to sit and read read all this stuff, but they don't. And so going with videos is just part of what doing what you have to do.
It's been a very long time since there's been a true gathering of revisionists in a meeting hall. It's been years since something like that's occurred, and we're striving towards having a conference sometime this year. And real world activism, I think, is really what's going to break the hoax.
What do you call real world activism? That's where everybody starts to go and run and hide in their corner because nobody wants. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about that subject on the Kodo message board. What was the subject again?
Okay. All right. Well, I will preface this by saying that I was talking a couple of weeks ago with Wilf Hank, who is a Canadian revisionist. Very good. He writes on the on that Rev blog that my AB articles are on. And we were talking about how we need to, we both believe in being a little more aggressive. The way the revisionist movement was decimated by these arrests and trials of revisionists and putting them in jail, because our most powerful, the most powerful revisionists who are really making a difference, Ernst Sundel, Germa Rudolph, and then Sylvia Stoltz, and who's just been released. Well, they're all released now, but they're under so many restrictions that they can't go back to the work they were doing without being thrown back in jail. So, and they really did, slow down a train that was moving along quite well. So now I think we need to regroup like you're talking about, and you're already starting it, and figure out which way to go now. So, you know, today on the, I saw it appeared on Thursday, last Thursday, but I just saw it on the Kodo debate forum, a post called Reflections on Strategy for Revisionism Going Forward by a poster named Kingfisher. Now, Kingfisher's been posting on Kodo for quite a while, and he I think, is a sincere revisionist, but he's all for going slow and not offending anybody and not getting anybody upset. And he just keeps pushing this along. And now here's somebody who doesn't give his real name, you know, doesn't go out there in front, you know, and yet he's telling us how we should go slow and we'll go into this. Not be known as deniers, you know, and you've named your site Holocaust denier, so you're just the opposite. And he has even commented about your film, Last Days of the Big Lie, that it's so very good, but he thinks you should tone down this and tone down that and tone down the other thing. So you know, this is different approaches.
Well, here's the example, the real world example we need to use going forward. Look at this birther movement that you could say they just succeeded. How did they succeed? Was it just on the internet? No. The internet was sort of what made it more of a laughable conspiracy theory, just the internet rumors and things like that. But what happened was they began to sue to uncover the records, first of all. But what really broke it out into the mainstream was Donald Trump. And you could say whatever you want about Donald Trump, and I would probably agree, but how he got Obama to release his alleged birth certificate was basically being loud and obnoxious in the real world, not on the internet. So,
now Donald Trump is a man who gets the news media attention.
Yeah.
Now, who do we have that's going to get news media? Now, if we could get Donald Trump to speak up for being interested in Holocaust revisionism, that would be great, wouldn't it?
That would happen.
We would get attention then.
But let's look at the stages that their movement went through. They started mostly as an internet thing, which, in America at least, I'd say that's where we are. It began to move into the Tea Party movement, you know, actual signs on the streets, people put up billboards, and then, you know, lawsuits were filed by people who gave their real names. then the state legislature started making laws, you know, that you have to show your birth certificate, et cetera.
Yeah, well, how did they get these state legislatures to do this?
Yeah, I mean,
are these like Republicans who are anti-Democrat, or, you know, is this a party politics thing?
Well, here's the deal, that the state legislatures and Donald Trump, they're not reaching out to the middle-of-the-road, you know, moderates. They're reaching out to the far-right Tea Party types. That's who they're reaching out to, and that's a really good sign for us. And that's what people, I'd say, on that thread on the CODO forum are missing out on, that there are politicians who will, mainstream figures who will reach out to a so-called far right, and we shouldn't be afraid to be passionate about our views and not a sort of boring academic type. So I think there's a lot of hope in that so-called birther movement that just happened.
Well, it's I think so. You know, I'm a believer that there's something very wrong with that whole birth certificate business, and I understand this new birth certificate that Trump is so proud of, that Obama supplied, is actually just another certificate of live birth. It's still not a birth certificate.
Yeah.
And so you know, they're still playing this game. Uh-huh. And anybody that's trying to not provide information that is not going to harm that person, you know, it's not going to harm him if he has a legitimate birth certificate for people to see it. You know, right there, it tells you that there's something very wrong. Well, about being passionate, you know, I'm very passionate about it, and I also think people should be more aggressive. And then there are these others who say, no, oh, that turns people off. As soon as they see that you are you deny it or something. You're supposed to. I really do question these people's loyalty or real identity or what they're really up to. Because if this effort to try to get all of us to, let's admit that there were, question the gas chambers. Let's just question a few things to get them to think about it.
They don't have a winning strategy.
No.
They don't have any way to stir the emotions of people. It's some sort of academic... I mean, it's one of the reasons I don't particularly like the word revisionist.
I know.
It's pretty weak. It's, you know, we just have to make a few changes here and there to the past. No, it's a major... a disgusting hoax that's been committed, and it's been used to just create horror throughout the world.
Mm-hmm.
It's destroying the world. It's used as a weapon, and it's time to dismantle that weapon. And it's not done by some sort of academic right on the internet all day about how this is wrong or that's wrong. The next phase has to be... First of all, we're in America. We're protected by the First Amendment. We have to start simply putting up flyers. People can still do that anonymously, but I'm going to be moving towards filing a lawsuit soon, and I find it is a great, great tactic, and hopefully will be successful. And I think it lets the other side know that, one, we're not afraid of them. One, we have the facts on it. I mean, two, we have the facts on our side. And they're the criminals. They should be on the defense. So we can't win by being on the defense, you know, on the internet. We have to sort of, especially, at least in America, and it's almost all in America that we have to do this, because it's illegal in, you know, many parts of Europe. So it's basically up to Americans to make the Holocaust truth movement into, we need to emulate the success of the birther movement, I'd say. And that's by real world activism gaining the attention of the mainstream. And all we would need is one or two figures. It could just be one article in a major magazine or newspaper that really gets the ball rolling. In the birther's case, that birther movement could have gone on forever, if it weren't for Trump being loud.
Well, it's still going on. I don't know that Trump has really solved it. They're not admitting it. I mean, they're still here's the birth certificate. And even Trump said, oh, I made him do that, as though he's accepting it. So,
I have to say he did. I mean, I think it would have kept being ignored, as our case, mm-hmm. as Holocaust denies, is ignored.
We need to find somebody like that. It's easier with the birther thing because that was a left-right political thing, Republicans, Democrats, and stuff.
Yeah.
And so, people, and it gets them into mm-hmm. the news. But they've got a real blackout on us. So, I think this AV story is important because it has broken out. There are those who say, no, this isn't right. And so that has gotten in the news, and I think this should be... Everybody should get behind this and overturn this thing, and not because it can still carry on. And next thing, there'll be all his books in the schools, and everybody will, even though there are people griping about it on the edges, it will still be mainstream, all right, like with Sizblatt. So, I think we need more people who are willing. This idea of having a conference is a good idea. And get people out of their houses and meeting together, and with some strong leaders who say, we need to start reinvent the Holocaust revisionist movement again.
Definitely,
in a sense.
Back to the birthers, just real quick. They succeeded because their point was pretty simple, and everyone has a birth certificate. They understand. Why don't you just release it?
Mm-hmm.
Our point is pretty complex when it comes down to it. It's made deliberately complex by, the Jews and the Holocaust promotion industry. And that's one of the main problems we've had, is we haven't really made our points clear. I would just say we haven't made our points clear and understandable to the average person. And I think that's really where video comes in. And it's pretty shocking. In the case of my video, I've sort of watched it, easily over 100 times while editing it and everything. And it's still shocking to me how brainwashed people are. Mm-hmm. But I think video is one of the best tools to unbrainwash them, you could say.
Your video is still up on YouTube, right?
Yeah, there's been a bunch of different people who have posted it on YouTube, and I'm actually close to finished on a second draft of it, which I'm pretty proud of, and it will be used to introduce to tens of thousands of people not particularly aware of our correct points. They'll be watching my video after Steven Spielberg and the company who produced his Oscar-winning film, The Last Days, after they're sued next month for their fraud. This is The Last Days is a documentary Steven Spielberg made. It won the 1998 Academy Award. And the film's a complete hoax from start to finish. And, it's advertised as literally on the front cover and the poster. It says everything you're about to see is true. But, it includes a woman who claims to have repeatedly defecated diamonds for a year in Auschwitz and on death marches. She claims Mengele removed her tattoo. She claims she escaped from inside a gas chamber. She claims she was selected to become a lampshade. It's just, it's silly, and this silliness is only really revealed on video. This is something, books or articles can't really get across. So,
mm-hmm.
people are going to be exposed to her false testimony.
Yeah, when you see these expressions that they have, things like that, you can't get that across in anything but on film.
Exactly. People know a liar when they see one.
You know, couldn't your film be shown as a film, even though it's been on internet for quite a while now? Couldn't it still be shown as a film at a theater and have a big special first presentation and so on?
It absolutely.
You know, California would be probably the best place because that's where most people are who are interested.
There's been some people who have been showing revisionist films in public libraries. Basically, they can't deny you showing these films at your own public library. So if anyone would want to show my film at their local public library, I'd send out a DVD once the next draft is done. And this is something that gets press in and of itself. In Montana especially, there's been a few groups that have been doing that. So public showings and, you know, probably a discussion afterwards are definitely something I'd like to do in the future.
Well, what about your revising, you know, you've been editing and revising this film. So the first, when you first offered it, you called it a draft. Now, when you get this all done, what's it going to be? You said you were going to divide it into chapters, or you're going to, or is it?
I'll release it for free on the internet again, the full version, as well as divide it into chapters.
But you're making a few changes, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm making a lot of changes.
Are you
going to
withdraw the first version and just have the second version, or it's going to be confusing, it seems to me, if you have them both.
Yeah, I'd probably withdraw the first. I've removed some of the speculation in the first, even though it's possible some of the speculation might be true. I don't necessarily know that. And, you know, it's also important, you know, I could debunk everyone in his Oscar-winning film, from the diamond defecator to the black guy who lies about liberating Dachau when no African Americans were involved with the liberation of any major concentration camps. But the important part is to keep on the people at the top, and that's Spielberg, and that's Hollywood. So the new draft will focus on them instead of these little liars who Spielberg and company use.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that's why it's important to go after the big people like Spielberg or Weasel, because all these little people are really sort of insignificant in comparison to their influence on the masses.
Well, I agree with you. Maybe that's another part of it, to pick our fights, to pick our subjects and not hit around all over the place. But that's why the serious revisionists that we still have that are busy now writing a new book, and have written several books, they do that. They're picking, they're going to the last aspect, which is the Einsatzgruppen, fables and so on and misinformation, and they're working on that now. So, well, Eric, we've run out of time. I think this has been a good bit of information for the public, and I hope the people who are interested in revisionism and Holocaust denial will pay attention to what's been said, and will definitely go to your newest website, revisionistworkshop.com, and see what's going on there and follow that. And we'll see if we can get a conference going this year.
Definitely. And my other site, my personal site, is very easy to remember. It's holocaustdenier.com. Thanks again for having me.
Okay. Thank you, Eric. And listeners, we have to say goodbye now. Please come back next week. I'm going to have, as if all goes well, Dr. Robert Farison as a guest. Good night.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at reasonradionetwork.com.
We'll be right back.